Accession number 14284, Reel 2.
Mr. Carling, Reel 2.
That resulted in a visit to the first aid post being absolutely necessary on this occasion, because I was bleeding very, very heavily from the wound. When I went in, the orderly told me that we'd more or less had it. They were expecting the Germans to take the first aid post over that afternoon. And I said, well, I'd rather not stay, and just put a pad on my neck and went back to brigade headquarters, where I was told that we'd been detailed to lay tapes from the Hartenstein Hotel down to the riverside. People were intending to, it was intended that people would pull out in the dark, following the path which we made. I got all my kit together and we set out to do this as soon as it was dark. It involved, for most people, wrapping their boots in blankets and that kind of thing. But I had been in plimsolls right through the operation, so it wasn't so difficult for me. About halfway down to the river, in the dark, we were engaged by a party coming in the opposite direction. We replied their fire, and they pulled out. And when we moved forward to the position where they'd been, we found two Thompson submachine guns. Now, none of our people had Thompson submachine guns, but I assumed that we'd come across a party of Poles coming up from the river, and they'd been trigger-happy, and so had we, and we were damn lucky that there weren't any dead bodies lying about with the Tommies. However, I felt rather good about it, because I had given my rifle to one of the fellas who'd been on a patrol with me. I was glad to have the Tommy gun because I had given my rifle to one of the chaps who'd been on a patrol with me, who had made an excuse that he couldn't come because he was a dispatch rider and he only had a 38 revolver. So I said, well, you take this, my boy. There's a rifle and bayonet for you. I'll take the 38. I'll be in the background. So I was armed again, as I would prefer to be, with a heavier weapon. It wasn't needed. We were very fortunate. Just as we reached the water side, a boat appeared within hailing distance. He'd obviously been putting the poles down, and he called out to us, "You fellas going across the river?" Turned out to be one of the Canadians who was running the ferry service. So my pal and I, Brian Thompson, were able to get into this boat with a few other fellas, and we jumped the queue and got across the river really before the very heavy strafing on the queue started. But we did see, of course, what a terrible time they were having before we actually got to the land on the other side. The barrage of mortar bombs that came down on them as soon as the flares located them was quite horrific. There must have been an awful lot of people lost, queuing up, waiting to be transported over the water. That was Arnhem.
Did you have much to do with the Dutch population?
Not until later. The only person, the only Dutch person of any significance was the girl in the first aid post that I've just been talking about, who was Dutch Red Cross, and had come in to the kitchen where I was lying and asked me if anybody had seen me yet, you see. And I said, yes, it's all right, I'm just going. And she said, you are not supposed to go, which was more or less the instructions they had had to tell everybody that under the rules of the Red Cross, the Germans had undertaken to accept all the patients in the first aid post as prisoners of war. I wasn't particularly keen to go into the bag, so I just took off without permission, I suppose.
You haven't said anything about your flight into Arnhem.
Oh, that. I suppose that was one of the most astonishing parts of my flying experience, really. The assembly of the aircraft for takeoff was really quite a sensational thing to see. And by the time we all got into the air, it was quite a procession, of course. We were right at the front with some reconnaissance people, and they wanted to be put down at a certain point on the landing zone so that they could get straight on and make contact with the parachute regiment people who had landed slightly north of us. As I already mentioned, Blubber Boyd was one of the most fantastic pilots in the regiment, of course. As soon as we got the word that that was the landing zone, he said, "I've got her, Colling." I hadn't heard a word from him all the way over. And I'm without the aircraft. He turned hard over to the starboard side, flew right across in front of all the other kites, which were coming up behind us, and put this thing down within feet of the point where these chaps wanted to get their vehicle onto the road. Our cargo was one Jeep and two motorcycles, which the recce people were taking over the railway line to contact the parachute troops. The landing was very, very rough indeed, of course. We landed on plough land. The undercart simply sank into the ground more or less halfway over the wheels and pulled the nose straight into the deck. We were up to our chins in Mother Earth when we stopped, and were a bit worried about getting our feet out because we were strapped to our rudder bars, you know, and had to sort of do a good deal of excavating to get ourselves free of the cockpit. Fortunately, the chaps at the back were fully genned up about offloading, and they got around and pulled the tail down, and that got us more or less free to get on with the job. These recce people were highly trained, of course. The sergeant was a Royal Ulster Rifles. They were all volunteers, you know. All the people from Northern Ireland volunteered for the army. And they were marvellous blokes, absolutely marvellous. What about flying over? Well, it was a matter of just sitting behind the tug and waiting for somebody to say, "That's the landmark over there," you know. It took about 3 hours. I did most of the flying on the way across. Blubber was the first pilot, of course, and he took off. More or less got us into position behind the towing aircraft. And simply said, right, you've got her. And I took over and flew most of the way on my own. Which was a straightforward job, you know. A long flight for me, of course. Most of my flying had been circuits and bumps, which was about half an hour at a time. But on both of the operations that I flew on, as second pilot, I did the really hard work following the towing aircraft.
And this was a hawser.
It was a hawser in the Arnhem effort. Yes, yes.
What?
When we got back, of course, it was treated as quite a sensational kind of effort. You know, people didn't really say that we'd failed. And as far as the regiment was concerned, and as far as the airborne forces were concerned, it wasn't a failure. It was a magnificent achievement. The planning was wrong. It was a damn fool idea to send three separate landings across, because there is one essential for an airborne operation: surprise. You've only got one chance. You've got to get down and get on with it. And the poor chaps who came on the second and third lift, well, they didn't really stand much chance. Although, for the most part, the people we were up against at the beginning, before the armour arrived, were just boys from a nearby training establishment and old home guard types and people of that kind. Mind you, they could really give you a nasty fright, you know. I mean, it only took one sniper to have everybody lying flat, particularly with the troops we had, because the first airborne were on their first, for most of them, on their first real battle experience. They'd had plenty of bullets flying over them, you know, in training, 6 feet up. But when they started to hit the ground in front of you, or when they started knocking the bloke next door out flat dead, it gave you a different kind of feeling about taking part in the thing. I'm not saying that people were unduly scared or cowardly or anything like that, but an airborne force is obvious to the defenders. The defenders make it their business to become hidden, and they attack you from behind the bushes all the time. That was something which we found very difficult on patrol in particular, because you could be walking down a path thinking it was all quiet, and some kid would step out with a Smicer and open up and then disappear. One kid made a serious error. He stepped out with a Smicer and fired from the hip, and I just happened to have my rifle ready and fired more or less from behind a tree, which is a rather more accurate way of dealing with the situation. Snipers. Well, I think the first one was one of the ones I should mention. Boyd and I were just more or less wandering about, looking over the land, when we saw these cattle, which had been obviously lying for a day or two, all bloated with their legs sticking up in the air. You know what dead cows look like. At one animal was sitting on his haunches. He was a horse. And he'd obviously been hurt. So I said to Boyd, "Oi, I'm going over to shoot that poor, you know." And I went over, put a bullet through his head with my rifle. The next thing I knew, I nearly had a bullet through my head. And when I got back to where Boyd was, he said, "From over there in that bush." And he had binoculars, of course. He was an officer. And he said, "There's something looks like a bit of fabric there. Can you see it?" And when I looked hard, I got the idea that something like a piece of cloth was in amongst the bushes. And I shot at that target. And we didn't get a shot back. I think it might have been that chap who fired at me. And I think I might have hit him. But this is one of the things about snipers. You can't always afford to go looking for them. This was one of the serious errors that some of our senior officers made. I went back, I think it was the second or third morning. I went down to brigade headquarters with the state, you know, the daily state, to show how many people we'd lost and so on, what rations we could do with, as if we were going to get any. And I was very surprised because I just walked straight into the place where the senior officers were all dug in their slit trenches. There were no sentries out or anything. And when I looked across through the trees, there were some houses, you know, the windows of some houses, overlooking the site where they were dug in. And this one of these colonels came over and said, "Okay, I've got it, Sergeant." And as I was sort of speaking to him, I saw this chap break the glass in the upper windows of this house. And I could quite clearly see a chap with a peaked, grey peaked cap, hard-faced character, and a rifle. So I immediately took a shot at him. And of course this officer said, "What the hell," you know, and all this kind of thing that they do when you take them by surprise. "Sniper," I said. And he looked over. "Ooh, all the people have been cleared out of those houses." I said, "Well, they've come back." And of course a brigadier had sort of got wind of it by then. And he said, "Oh, we'd better have somebody go over and have a look." "Come on, Jones," he said, "you and I'll go and have a look." The next thing we know, he's upstairs looking for snipers himself. When they look around, Jerry had moved in downstairs. And they had to sit upstairs whilst Jerry was in downstairs. Lucky for them, they didn't get caught and taken prisoner.
Which brigadier was this?
I don't remember his name. But it was the kind of thing that, you know, people were, the kind of daft thing people were liable to do. They thought because all the Dutch people had been cleared out, that Jerry wouldn't come in. Jerry knew every inch of the ground. The people who'd been stationed there knew all the Dutch people, knew who lived where and what was to do. And were familiar with the ground. That is a great asset to anybody who's fighting a battle. I don't know whether I hit the sniper or not, but it was the kind of thing that stayed in my mind for a long time, you can imagine.
Did you suffer much from lack of water at Arnhem?
I don't think you could say that we did suffer from it. We didn't have an awful lot, but it rained a lot. So that you don't really feel thirst so much in wet weather, you know? And in any case, it wasn't safe to light fires to make tea. The catering arrangements were non-existent from the outset. I don't think we ever saw anybody come around with rations. I believe Blubber Boyd at one point had found some people who had been able to get some of the stuff out of a container and had come back somewhere near our lines, and he scrounged some of it from there and he brought it back to his part of the dispersal area and was very meticulous in dishing it out as a proper army officer should be. I was a bit sort of hardened to that kind of thing. What I found, I kept. But it was mainly just carrots out of people's gardens and, bits and pieces of grub of that kind. We didn't eat. You can take it. We did not eat. I think I had one bite of food. I went down looking for some people who were supposed to have seen a tank, you know, how you got that kind of thing happening. And there was one of the houses which had been taken over by the Red Cross people. So I went in, into the cellar, left my rifle and so forth at the door. And these people said, you can't come in here, you know, you're not wounded. I said, what's this and what's this and what's this? I said, I haven't really come for that. I'm looking for the South Staffordshire people. Well, they didn't understand that they were Dutch anyhow. But they had some goulash, which they had cooked. They weren't ready to dish that out, of course, but they said to me, there is a German in the shed. So I said, oh, yes. I said, why, is he wounded or anything? What do you know? We don't know, but there's a German in the shed. So I thought, well, I'd better go and have a look. And I found this fella lying in the shed. He'd been hit in the leg, and he'd been bleeding very hard and just about on his last legs. So I sort of went over and had a look, and I better stop it bleeding. You can't just leave people lying. And I tied my first aid, around his leg tight, and he eventually came to. And he said, you're a good type, Tommy, or something to that effect, you see. And I said, you should be in the house. They don't want me in the house, he said. Well, they said they didn't know whether you were wounded or not. However, I didn't go back and tell them. I just had to leave him there. But I had some of their goulash before I came away. And I'm not sure whether they knew about it or not. I just went in to report, you know, I've seen the man. The goulash was there. So I took a couple of handfuls. Oh, and I had a shave of all the things you can do. There was water there, warm water. I had this horrible growth, of course. Hadn't had a shave for 3-4 days. And I had a cutthroat razor in my pocket, which I'd always carried around. And I shaved my whiskers off and had some goulash. Came out and picked up my rifle and found old Dance, the chap who'd come down the road with me, lying flat on the ground with blood gushing out of his mouth. He'd been hit whilst he'd been waiting about. I left him for dead. I took his fighting knife. He still had his knife in the sheath on his leg. And I'd lost mine earlier on. And I put his in my sheath. I've got it in the and the doing there. At, of all the things that can happen, when we arrived at Finmere for discharge, old Dance was in the next bed to me. He'd been in Stalag, was picked up by Jerry, wounded, and came back to Finmere for discharge at the same time as me.
What condition were you in when you got out of Arnhem?
I slept for about a week. Obviously, we hadn't had anything to eat, so we really needed quite a bit of grub. But my wounds had all stayed reasonably clean. I didn't need to go into hospital. I was fit to go home on leave.
Can you tell me about the next operation? About the
Varsity.
Rhine crossing?
Yes. Yes, that really was a different kettle of fish. You probably know we'd lost an awful lot of our people. And they had posted young RAF pilots to the regiment. These chaps had come back with their wings from Canada and Africa and, you know, all over the place, and were given the chance to fly gliders or be grounded. There was no need for RAF pilots towards the end of the war. They'd more or less come to the end of their usefulness. So we got, I think, about 600 or 700 of them to make up our numbers, which had been sadly depleted, of course, on the two previous operations. I became very friendly with one chap. He was Tommy Tomlinson. I think mainly because he had a car. The RAF had the privileges which we didn't have. That is to say, they could get petrol for motor cars. We couldn't get motor cars because we couldn't have petrol. And Tommy had this old Standard 14, and I used to go about with him a bit. We nearly missed the operation as a result. We tended to ignore standing orders a bit, and we'd gone out in the afternoon before everybody else had more or less finished what they were doing, and we didn't get back until the small hours. And whilst we were away, word had come through that we were moving to, from Earl's Cone, anyhow, where we were stationed, we were moving to the takeoff point, more or less in the small hours, you know, before 6 o'clock. Which meant that we had to get our kit together and packed and just check our stuff on the wagon. There was no question of being able to move the car. So Tommy's car was left at Earl's Cone, I think it was. And poor Tommy never got back to collect it, I'm afraid. We lost an awful lot of the RAF pilots. It wasn't a fair deal for them, you know. They had been brought in because they could fly. But our regiment needed people who could fight afterwards. You know, the flying was just a means of getting into battle. The real danger was when you hit the ground later.